This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 58, and I have the pleasure to be joined today by Laurent Cassis, MD of CEC Capital, who has worked in the ETF industry for 14 years. We've spent a few episodes recently in the heady heights of the super big picture, so let's get back to the coalface and dive in depth into an important area of financial services. ETFs, exchange-traded funds, have been mentioned many times on the podcast, always in passing, so I thought it was more than overdue to attack them head-on. Like Banquo's ghost in Macbeth, ETFs are the thing that haunt the whole investment management fintech scene. If, in essence, you can gain direct exposure to equity markets in a balanced way via a vehicle with minimal fees, what exactly is there for investment management fintech to disrupt? Conceptually, ETFs are simple. They started life as traded funds. If you like, index tracker investment trusts, although that's not quite accurate, as Laurent will explain soon. According to Wikipedia, since 1993 in the US, when they were first created, an unbelievable $2 trillion have been invested in them, hence the importance of the subject, especially for fintechs. If you want to disrupt a $2 trillion market, here's one for you. They have also moved a long way from their origin as index trackers with, to quote Wiki, by the end of 2015, ETFs offered 1,800 different products covering almost every conceivable market sector, niche, and trading strategy. Like many things in financial services, think payments for example, ETFs are conceptually simple, yet have plenty of wrinkles in practice. As Laurent is not sitting opposite me looking anorexic, we can assume that these complexities are more than enough to keep a man well-fed for over a decade. So that's ETFs per se. But like everything in FS, the wave of innovation that is fintech is lapping on many shores. If ETFs have inhibited the growth of one area of fintech, what is fintech doing to ETFs? Laurent certainly has feet in both old FS and new FS camps, being the non-executive chairman of the blockchain investment company Coincilium. So he's the ideal expert to talk to us about the sector today. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Laurent, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on your show, Mike.
And clearly to our listeners, you sound somewhat French, although fortunately for you, you're in England at the moment, or maybe not fortunately given the rubbish weather which I always refer to on the podcast this year.
I'd hoped that my accent actually wouldn't give it away, but it does in most cases. I'm half French, half Brit, and I spent most of my educational life in the UK. I went to public school and then I ended up going to university here in London.
Ah, excellent. So I hope you've got these sort of French genes for cooking, because French cooking is far better than English cooking, British cooking.
I try and do my best in the kitchen. I don't often succeed, but it's generally quite interesting when I have friends coming over.
Excellent. And so how do you get from sort of being half French and half British to being the world's expert on ETFs?
Well, I guess it came very much by accident. Early in my career, I was working for a very big custodian, one of the largest ones in the US, and they seconded me to Germany when I started working out of Boston, so your listeners will probably know which one it is. And we were there to set up the Treasury Department, and we quickly came around the belief that they were doing very well in the US, and these ETFs were expanding quite quickly, so we started promoting them in Europe. And I sort of moved into the transition management world, which is not something that is atypical to most professionals in the city.
And so transition management world is what exactly?
It's effectively the procedure of managing a fund manager who has been sacked by his employer to managing the new portfolio of the manager in a new company. So what generally happens is if a company decides to stop the activity of that fund, they will liquidate the portfolio. But in order to try and maintain certain aspects of investment, they will reinvest it. So that's called through a procedure called portfolio trading, program trading. So you buy and sell baskets of stock using potentially contracts as well, futures, and trying to align the market so that there's no slippage or big movements in the market. And with a basket came very naturally the ETF. So what is effectively an ETF? It is a marketable investment vehicle that allows you to buy and sell through the trading hours of the exchange, so they're traded on the exchange, a basket of stock, a basket of bonds, it could be also commodities, through a single share. So if you look at indices such as the FTSE 100, instead of buying the whole FTSE 100, you can now buy a share of one index of the FTSE that will track the performance of the FTSE. And this can be done throughout the course of a day. So the nice thing about it is that they track their net asset value. So through a very simple calculation, you can have the whole FTSE 100 in a basket and see exactly where that price should be. So that would be the net asset value. And based on the market performance or pressures between buyers and sellers, people can then have some kind of arbitrage, so to say, but I wouldn't go too much into the arbitrage world, in buying shares in the index. So if you believe that the FTSE will go up, you would buy FTSE ETFs. If you believe that the Eurostox would go up, you would buy a Eurostox ETF. If you believe that the banking in a sector is going to perform well, you would buy a bank ETF sector.
And in terms of the point I mentioned before, that one way of thinking about ETFs, which may not be completely precise, is that they're a kind of investment trust, in that an investment trust is something listed on a stock exchange that you can buy and sell in the hours that the stock exchange is open, and it can hold a bunch of stocks, and it will go to generally a discount, but sometimes a premium, the P2P GI. The investment trust in the UK that invests in alternative finance went to a premium, although it's now at a discount like most investment trusts. But why isn't that analogy accurate in the ETF case then?
So investment trusts, as you quite rightly say, Mike, are products that are also traded on the exchange. However, they tend to trade mostly towards the NAV. So whenever the company decides to strike the portfolio at a particular time of the day, this is when you would invest. So you would create units and you would also disinvest and then you would sell these units. Now, the investor is totally at the mercy of the company that issued these investment trusts because they decide the NAV.
Right.
With an ETF, it's a totally transparent product. And what it allows them to see is because they are invested into listed securities, so a basket of stock, for instance, the FTSE 100, you know exactly at any time during the trading hour what that ETF should be worth. Now, you've mentioned trading at a premium and at a discount, and this happens exactly the same way in an ETF. There are discrepancies in the market. First of all, because some ETFs are trading in different exchanges. So we're looking at Europe, Paris, Amsterdam, Switzerland, and Sweden. So obviously you incur potentially some currency exposure at the same time. But if we look at the Eurostox 50, it has potentially over 55 ETFs on the market.
Wow.
And some of them are in different currencies.
Yeah.
And some of them actually trade a different time zone. So you put this into perspective and there will be some arbitrage. So sometimes, when I use the word arbitrage, they can be traded at a premium to their net asset value or sometimes at a discount. And the reason why we have these premium and discount is because we compare them to what's holding underneath, so the basket of stock. So a basket of stock might be cheaper to buy than the ETF. And the reason why this may be is there may be an investor who might have bought 1 million shares of the FTSE 100, so the price of the ETF may be slightly higher than the basket of stock. And that's the reason why we have these discrepancies. Another one may be that you're trading a world emerging market ETF, and depending on various time zone, the currency might not reflect accurately with some of these markets that are closed. So let's take an example. We are in Europe, we're in London, Asia is now closed. America is not open yet, but you are trading a basket of global stocks. So how do you actually manage these exposures? When you buy an ETF, for you, you're completely oblivious to what happens behind the scenes. But for a market maker who provides that pricing, it's very important for him to protect himself from market exposures that are closed so that they will go onto the futures market and protect themselves there whilst you get exposure to your global basket.
I see, and I can see how that flows through from the transition management process and the complexities that we mentioned where they're arising from, because there were so many ETFs out, as you say. So compared to investment trusts, which may typically even trade at 10 or 15% discount, in the case of an index tracker ETF, of course, they're going to trade at far narrower discounts. So what's typically the range?
We call it a sort of trading channel, which is effectively the arbitrage channel, or where the tolerance level of the discount is to where the premium level is vis-a-vis the net asset value. And these levels, when I started in the ETF market, which is at least 12 years ago, and being involved in pricing the Euro Stoxx 50 at the time, we were looking at margins of around 10%, which is quite extortionate. But at the time, you know, these products didn't have much liquidity. We didn't really have much to hedge ourselves against. And particularly when you looked at global exposure, there weren't even a futures market to protect yourself in certain countries. So when you look, for instance, at the US, and still that exists today, there are no sector futures. The market is difficult to hedge, so people use baskets and other Delta One product, I call them proxies, to protect or to hedge themselves. So when you look back at 10 years ago, where there were only a handful of market makers, when you looked at the order book, there were probably a bid that was vis-a-vis the net asset value of around 5-6%, an offer equally around 5-6%. Now, this changed very quickly as the investors starting to embrace it. Now, why would they have embraced ETF vis-a-vis investment trust or unit trust, which is still a major dominance in the UK? And why is because there is an upfront fee, there is a management fee that you're paying, and there is potentially a performance fee. You do not get this in ETFs. You are paying a very low fee for the management fee, and that's it. So your entry level to ETFs is almost zero, except for the course of you holding the ETF, you will pay a management fee, which is calculated on a daily basis. Okay, so you barely see that price change.
Yes. So typically then, if we're taking the Euro Stoxx 50 you mentioned, or the FTSE 100, just a typical ETF that's mimicking those, what kind of fee are you paying per annum to the managers? We'll come back to what the manager might be in a minute.
So indeed, the managers will be the large asset managers in the city that we all know. Some of them are more specialized in ETFs, some of them are specialized in index tracking, and some of them are specialized more in structured products. But 10 years ago, if you look at the Euro Stoxx 50, you were looking at around 65 basis points management fee. On a Euro Stoxx 50 today, you're probably paying the better of 12 basis points. So that's 0.12%.
Okay, and that's the only fee, is it?
That's the only fee.
So there's no trustee fees hidden away behind that. That's a total number.
So you have what's called the TER, which is the total expense ratio, which encompasses effectively the whole cost of the ETF. And this may include marketing, it may include management fee, which we're talking about. It may include maybe some custodian fee and legal fee. But overall, the whole cost that you're paying on a Euro Stoxx 50 will not exceed 12 basis points.
I see. So that is clearly very, very competitive. And going back to what I said before, means that fintech can't particularly disrupt that structure, because if you want extra exposure, from what you say, it's very simple for me to go out this afternoon and buy, I don't know, let's say $1 million of a ETF that tracks the FTSE, $100,000 the US, and $250,000 of the Euro Stoxx, and I've got a whole diversified portfolio at a very low management fee. And are these things allowed in PEPs in the UK?
I'm not sure if the word PEP still exists today.
Oh, ISAs or whatever they are. For our overseas listeners, there are various tax-efficient investment structures in the UK, when I can never quite remember how much I had to put in these days, but something about £10,000. And we did a show a few ago with Goji about the IFISA, which allows you to invest in alternative finance assets. But I presume you can just buy ETFs in those.
That is correct. So you have your ISAs, where you can invest the whole amount per annum into an ETF, and your SIP, if you want to manage your own pension, which I guess more and more people are doing nowadays in Europe and in the UK. In the US, for instance, under the what's called 401k, which is your own
retirement plan, yeah.
Yes, people have now more than 50% of their investment into ETFs.
Ah, so these are where the big numbers are coming from. Well, as people who listen to the show will know, that I don't really sort of know very much, and I do very little of what I do know. But one of the things I learned decades ago was that index tracking was a very simple way of outperforming all of your friends who are paying managers lots of money to sort of decide whether BP or Shell's going up. So I got that bit right, but I've been extremely slow and very remiss myself personally. I just still invest in the Legal & General UK Index Tracker Fund, largely because I never really had the time to sort of sort it out. But for people listening who are doing a silly thing like that, they absolutely should personally investigate ETFs, because the one thing's guaranteed, if you've got an investment for sort of 10 years and you're paying 0.5% per annum more, you're just throwing the money away. So I can see how that works. And just to finish off on the structure of ETFs before we get to sort of the sexier stuff. So technically, what is an ETF? So technically, an investment trust is a company. It's a limited company. It's, you know, it's a company in the same way that BP is a company. It just happens to be run in a certain way. It's a long time since I managed unit trusts myself. But unit trusts are, he says, a trust of some kind. So what legally is an ETF?
Well, they have what's called a UCITS compliant application. So it allows them to be passported into Europe, which is one of the issues we have today with Brexit, is yeah. We will be able to do so. So one other thing your listeners should be aware of is that ETFs are registered mostly in Ireland and in tax vehicles, which are much more advantageous for, again, reducing your cost structure of the fund. So that could be Jersey, Guernsey as well, and then also Luxembourg. And they offer a lot more advantageous for reducing the cost. The issue with unit trust is that you have an upfront fee. So because they are, in most cases, closed-ended products, ETFs aren't, they're open-ended products, so you can freely create and redeem them. And this can happen at any time during the course of a day. And this will be done through what's called an authorized participant, which is generally a market maker or a bank that will issue more shares. So how does he do this? So if we take again the example of a FTSE 100, let's say that a client comes to him and wants to buy 2 million shares of FTSE 100, which is not an unusual thing these days. He will probably do this over the counter because there's not enough liquidity on the market. He may want to trade it over the course of a day, but the market maker will soon find out that there isn't enough out there to deliver to his client who's buying 2 million shares. So what he will do is he will buy at the same time a basket of underlying stocks, here the FTSE 100, hold this for the day. At the end of the day, where the net asset value is striked, generally around 4:30, he will then deliver the basket of stock to the issuer, so again, one of these big asset management company, and in return, the asset manager will issue shares of the ETF that he can then deliver to his clients. And the process of this creation redemption will allow the market maker to make a small amount of money, because there is always a discrepancy between the basket of stock versus the ETF. And here we're talking about the net asset value. So if you incorporate, for instance, currency and also market at a close, then obviously it's up to the market maker to take a position as where he believes maybe where the market will be, considering some of these market will be closed. And then he will receive the shares from the issuer. And by reconciliating his position versus the basket, he will make a small amount of money out of this. In unit trust, everything is dealt with the issuer. So there is no middleman that helps that process. So everything is done internally. And because it's not really that transparent, we don't really know what happens in terms of the delivery of these shares that you're getting. So unit trusts have been in the market for a long time, and they were the first things that IFAs and pension funds have been invested in. And until we saw the cost adapting, and you've mentioned a very good point here, the disruption. When you saw the disruptive side of ETF coming in, we are now, you mentioned $2 trillion are now fully invested. Well, as of last month, it's actually $3 trillion.
Wow.
So we are seeing a huge explosion into the market, and not only into equities. We are seeing also the likes of fixed income, and also again, commodities is going back in fashion. So when there is an index available, there will probably be an ETF. And so today, you and I, as simple investors, can now almost buy anything that is out there. This was not available 10 years ago. We could not buy gold the same way as we can through an ETF on the exchange.
So you can now buy gold ETFs and silver ETFs?
Correct. And you can buy a basket of precious metal. You can even buy a basket of industrial metals. Things that were not possible, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago. There are companies out there that offer exposure to these precious metal or industrial metal, or even the general commodity, agriculture market. If you believe that, you know, there is some price tightening in the price of the food that you're buying at the supermarket, you might want to hedge this with an agriculture ETF. And people are doing this.
I see. So just thinking about the sort of investment management fintech thing that I mentioned, one of the problems I think in the first wave of fintech innovation which is apart from things like P2P and bitcoins and equity crowdfunding, a lot of them are just trying to be a digital version of the old world. So investment management fintech may just basically be trying to replicate a cheaper version of what your fund manager was doing beforehand. But from what you're explaining, clearly, if we're going to have a second wave of innovation there, then I could see that it would be a very exciting proposition for a fintech to form itself and allow people to invest in all these kind of crazy things, you know? And you can wrap that up in the context of, as you say, whether you've got an exposure to food prices or, who knows, property prices. Do ETFs ever get near very liquid stuff like property, or does it just stop at things like gold and silver and commodities which could be traded against it?
Well, it's actually quite ironic, Mike, that you mentioned property as liquid. Effectively, property stocks are not liquid at all.
I meant illiquid.
But yes, there are ETFs that track an index in the property market. It could be a commercial one, generally it is, or it can be a residential one, which is a bit more difficult. But this will be done with the investment of companies that invest in property. So if you look at the UK property index, it follows a basket of FTSE 250 stocks. So you would be buying into these companies, so the likes of Barrett. If you take a European, there could be companies like Skanska as well. All of these companies, they invest in infrastructure or property. You would be able to buy an ETF in that form.
Excellent. Well, I'm quite happy with my idea of the day that fintech could easily form itself and offer me, in the nice, simple, clear way that good digital interfaces work, a whole host of buttons to press and a whole host of interesting things to invest in, above and beyond maybe the core of the portfolio, invested in the FTSE and the Euro stocks and all that kind of stuff. And I haven't actually come across myself a fintech that's doing that, will allow me to buy crazy things that just literally the click of a button. As I say, the ones that I've tended to see will let me buy the same old boring stuff I've been buying in the past, just make it slightly easier. So moving on to the world of fintech, it's a good lead-in. You were telling me that one day you had a dream, a crazy dream or a new dream or whatever, and it was like many dreams, it was a good dream, but actually turned out a bit harder in practice. So tell me about Bitcoin ETFs. Why do you need a Bitcoin ETF? Because as I understand, Bitcoin should be in principle easy to buy and sell. We'll gloss over all the problems with Bitcoin for the moment.
Well, yes. So around 2013, I was finishing up a pretty large project on an ETF mandate. And during the year, your listeners may remember that this is when the price of Bitcoin went from around $50 to $100 to $1,100 in a matter of a couple of months.
Yeah.
So this obviously attracted quite a lot of interest, and people wanted to get involved in potentially the investment side of Bitcoin. And having covered the majority of asset classes in the ETF, I spoke to my partners and wondered whether we were able to duplicate a digital cryptocurrency ETF, if that was possible. We looked at what there was out there, and of course, Bitcoin came to light. At the time, in November 2013, it was trading around $1,000, and then it rapidly went down. So we opened wallets, as one does, e-wallets, they call it. We opened a few exchange accounts, which was very simple at the time. You hardly needed much KYC, to a lot of people's disbelief. And we started trading Bitcoin. And we soon realized the procedure to have Bitcoin exposure. It was actually quite mind-blowing.
Oh, really? Interesting.
On the one end, it was fascinating to be able to buy effectively a digital currency. But on the other hand, the procedure in order to get there was incredibly cumbersome. And as much as people think that it's quite easy to buy Bitcoin, which it effectively is, the whole process of managing that investment was really difficult. And we thought of, may there be a way that we can go onto a regulated exchange where we offer a investment vehicle that tracks the price of Bitcoin, and how could we replicate this through potentially an ETF? Well, we looked at the structure, and unfortunately, the way an ETF is designed is buys a basket of stocks. And here we were talking about one security. So obviously, the concept of the exchange-traded fund wouldn't work because it doesn't represent a fund. So we looked at other structure, and the one that is most akin to your listeners will be the gold ETF, when in fact it's not a gold ETF, it's a gold ETN, which is an exchange traded note.
Okay, and the difference between a note and a fund in this context is?
In simple terms, an exchange traded fund is you're buying the underlying basket physically and you're exchanging it for a share of the ETF. In a note, the pure definition is that you invest in a debt structure where the debt will then buy the investment, and in exchange you will receive the underlying performance of that investment into a investment vehicle. So to make that simple, the debt will buy a investment product. It will then hold it physically if it can. It can be futures exposure. And if it does, the custodian will then issue or mimic the price of that performance onto a what's called the exchange traded note, so effectively an ETF. That is done with a gold today. So because you cannot have a basket inside your ETF, you effectively buy one security. And the security here will allow you to, through the structure of a note, expose yourself to the price of the gold. And so we thought, yes, let's do the same thing with Bitcoin. We will create an exchange-traded note. The note will effectively buy the Bitcoin through its debt. The debt will be held with a custodian, and in exchange, the custodian will deliver an ETF share that will mimic the price of Bitcoin. So the same process works with buying and selling through the creation-redemption process. You are buying shares onto the market. The market maker will hopefully mimic the price of Bitcoin. So let's say that Bitcoin is worth today about $570. Then you're hoping that either the ETN will be worth $570 or maybe a fraction of it. So to make it simple, maybe $57. So it becomes easier. Yeah. So it's a 10. We're using a factor. So for the entry level is easier. So we went ahead, and that was our dream. And we thought, well, when we went to see retail brokers, because generally speaking, institutional clients do not buy Bitcoin today. Yeah. And that is one of the biggest challenges that we have. And we can talk about the issues there and the regulation. We were very encouraged by the amount of their client asking if they could buy Bitcoin. And this is where this concept came to life.
So that all sounds great. So what could possibly go wrong then?
Exactly. What could possibly go wrong? Well, you will have seen and heard news about how Bitcoin is being hacked and how the whole concept through these exchanges are being breached through security. And that creates a lot of uncertainty.
So just pressing pause for those listeners who don't read Bitcoin news every day. Of course, everybody will have heard via the 9 o'clock news on the television that the Mt. Gox, Nox, whatever it was in Japan that fell over a long time ago.
Mt. Gox.
That's right. Thank you. Yes. And there was another one recently going back to the hacking. So just very briefly tell people what that was for those who haven't heard of it.
So the last hacking happened 2 months ago through an exchange called Bitfinex, which is effectively one of the largest exchange of buying and selling Bitcoin. And what's happened is, as I mentioned earlier, you create an e-wallet, just like you would have in your pocket. You would have physical cash. Here you would have digital cash in this e-wallet. And these e-wallets have two ways of being stored. Either what's called hot storage, which is through your mobile phone. So you can carry it with you, just like you would with your purse. And you can be in town and paying cash. And with your e-wallet, you can buy food and just highlight a sort of a QR code. Very simple. Or what you'd have generally by these organizations is cold storage, where the custodian holds the Bitcoin through a private key that is not connected to the internet. Unfortunately, in this case, and through various regulatory hurdles that they had with various governing bodies, they were forced to have hot wallets, unfortunately. Uh-huh. And this is where the hacking came. It's more easier to hack through hot wallet because it's connected to the internet.
Of course.
Than it is with cold storage.
And I think from what I read, the other significant difference, which is that Mt. Gox some time ago was known by people in the industry to be a little bit dodgy. The bigger concern this year, and Bitcoin's a whole other topic we're not going to get into, but the bigger concern this year was actually it was, quotes, unquote, a reputable custodian that people kind of trusted and didn't expect to have this kind of problem?
Yes, so you can say this.
Or is that just their PR department telling me that via the media?
Well, there is some truth. And unfortunately, the press is very quick to look at the negatives and they don't generally add the, you know, what's circling around it. But they had been forced again to work with hot wallets, which hadn't really helped them. And this is where the hacking came. With the case of Mt. Gox, which happened 2 years ago, this was actually stolen. So someone actually went into the wallets and stole the Bitcoin. And as much as your listeners will think, well, I thought that Bitcoin was untappable, you know, you couldn't trace them. How can these Bitcoins suddenly disappear? Well, it's just like your cash. When you hold in cash, you have a number on your notes, but you can still have that money stolen or you can lose it. And this is exactly the same thing. One of the aspects of what underpins Bitcoin is the technology. And the technology we haven't discussed, but is blockchain. And this is where a lot of attention at the moment is going to, is that it is untappable. It is an immutable environment and technology. And this is tamper-proof. What it lies behind with a digital currency is somewhat much more dubious. And this obviously raises question of security. And this is where the regulators need to intervene.
Excellent. Okay, so that's a very interesting case study of where, with you straddling both worlds. I mean, the blockchain thing, we'll have to do an episode on separately soon. But in terms of one of the biggest successes of, let's call it, existing financial services, has been ETFs, which are now multi-trillion dollar businesses. And you're trying to connect that to the new world of FS and things like Bitcoin. And actually, the failure was more on the new world than the old world. The old world of how you do ETFs, how you do ETNs is really well known and actually has got a lot of flexibility in it. But really, it was sort of let down by the new bit and the Bitcoin.
Exactly, Mike. And that's one of the biggest challenges that we faced in this industry. There are people wanting to issue and to launch funds that can have some digital currency attached to it. There is a demand out there. We know it. A lot of people are buying Bitcoin. At the moment, Bitcoin is valued at around $10 billion. So there is definitely some interest. What we are seeing is really a regulatory issue and also a commission one from a tax perspective. And I'll come into this. It's very simple. Today, there are certain countries that allow the use of Bitcoin as a transaction or maybe even as a tender. Today, there are countries that don't. And one we've seen recently, you might have heard, is the exemption of VAT in this country, which has been very favorable to Bitcoin. But in other countries such as Ireland, they do not recognize or they do not qualify Bitcoin as a qualified investment. And so today, if that were the case for us launching a Bitcoin ETF, we would be incurring tax behind it. And so it wouldn't make it commercial viable.
Wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So, as I say, and as you've explained very clearly, the ETF world has been incredibly successful, has grown massively into multi-trillion dollar business. There are many fintech sectors which would love to grow massively into multi-trillion business. And my podcast, rather than being listened by 3,000, maybe listened by 3 million in a year's time if this happens.
It will after this interview.
It will after this one. I mean, that was my main hope actually for marketing this year, was once I did ETFs, the market would expand massively. So just very briefly, what can fintech learn from the success of ETFs? What lessons are there in how ETFs has actually worked out really well? And what could actually fintech take from that and grow really well itself?
Well, fintech is a word that has been used potentially 2 or 3 years ago. So it's very new. And when it's new, it also creates what we call disruption. And this is where I think fintech allows you to have some kind of disruption. Today, it's mostly in the world of financial markets, so transaction. And where certain fintech companies have evolved very quickly is in the payment processing and also in the settlement and clearing business. And this is where I think there is a lot of interest today that the fintech world can learn from the ETF. As I said, ETFs have been around now for the better of 15 years, in this country at least. And where they started off was very small. And then people picked up on effectively their regulatory environment, their cost effectiveness, and also the integrity. As people started embracing them, more and more institutional clients are doing the same thing. So in the fintech world, where I feel that the industry can learn from the ETF is certainly a regulatory one. We've had many, many discussions with the regulators as to how we can make ETFs more secure, more trustworthy, and more simple for the investors, and particularly for investors like you and I in the street that want to buy products that are easy to understand, and at the same time, that will give you exposure to markets that you want. And this is exactly the same thing. And this can only happen today through disruption. We've seen the likes of small companies coming out and disrupting very large organization, payment company organization, that have effectively launched a product within 2 years that themselves needed some 15 to 20 years to do.
Yes.
And this is where I think the fintech space can really learn a lot. So it needs a lot more lobbying with the regulators. It needs a lot more support from the government. And we're seeing this in the UK. The UK government has been very supportive of fintech. Not so long ago, we had the Chancellor of the Exchequer supporting that space. They created an Innovate Finance separate unit to promote exactly that space. And we've seen investment last year of more than $1 billion in this space. So what we need to see is much more conducive approach to the regulators. And then by having this, it will embrace much more the investors, thinking that there is much more integrity and security, that people feel that there is a need to invest into this space. ETFs have had a rough ride as well. At the beginning, a lot of people were very skeptical. We had a lot of journalists from very famous financial newspapers that were very against them. And there has been a few scandals, very one recently by the likes of a Swiss trader that actually ended up going to prison as a result of trading ETFs. And we've seen this in the same situation in France not so long ago. I happen to have known both of them.
Hopefully not close personal friends.
Yes. But it's had a rough ride as well. So in terms of fighting for these disruption, we will see the light of better use of the fintech industry and making more integral to what you and I need to use. And today it's payment processes, it's transactional. You mentioned disruption in the financial markets of companies that have started, particularly in the ETF space. We've talked about Nutmeg. This is another company that has done very well in disrupting the asset management space with innovative products, and they've only been there for a couple of years.
Yes, it's very interesting, you know, given the sort of setbacks and consolidation and other euphemisms that's going on at the moment, particularly in alternative finance, to take this much bigger picture view that actually ETFs have grown massively over 25 years or so. And change doesn't happen immediately. As you say, sometimes a lot of change happens. But actually, very often, it's a bit like growing up. It just takes time. Time has to go by, and all the pointers that you mentioned are vital for the future. So I think that's quite optimistic. So in terms of just wrapping up the show, Laurent, clearly, you know, not just a hell of a lot about ETFs. You haven't just spent over a decade doing it, but also you've been very active in applying it to some of the newer fintechy technologies. So if listeners have any commercial angle on this, I'll include a link in the show notes and they can find you with that, and you can help them disrupt excitingly. As I say, my simple idea of the day is I just love to see a website where I can invest in anything like gold, you name it, silver, commodities, melons, just a click of a button. That'd be much more fun than just buying the sort of index tracker funds. So that's you and your business is doing that. And then just very briefly, because we must come back to them, just very briefly, in terms of you being the non-executive chairman of Coincilium, why don't you tell us about Coincilium and we must have them on the show, actually, because they are themselves a listed company. The world's only listed blockchain company, is that right?
That is right, Mike. I came to be in contact with management last year when they were doing a fundraise in this space. So Coincilium is an early stage investment company that focuses purely on blockchain startups. And I mean by startups, very early stage, and they haven't actually delivered a product.
That's fairly common for most blockchain companies, isn't it?
Today, it's the majority of them.
Yes,
you're
exactly.
Absolutely right.
You're not short of candidates.
Absolutely. What we do is we tend to provide more support hands-on with them so that they have at least a runway in which they will be able to deliver their products, because this is one of the issues that most fintech companies don't have today unless they raise a substantial amount of money. So I came in contact with them through a fundraise. I joined the board prior to them going public in September as a non-executive director. So obviously I provided my expertise through my contacts in financial markets, and they went to a exchange called ISDX, which is the ICAP exchange, through the market growth segment. And it was seen as the first blockchain investment company that is publicly listed, so first to market. And we have a portfolio of 14 blockchain companies today. And I'm sure you'd like to learn more about this, and you may want to engage with the CEO. I am now today the non-executive chairman, and my role really is to manage more the board in terms of its strategy so that the executive committee can execute the strategy that the board produces.
Exactly. And as we were discussing before, 2 weeks ago, Jeff Miller was on the show talking all about boards and fintechs and corporate governance and how important that is. And absolutely, we'll definitely have Coin Salim on the show. As anybody who's involved in fintech will have heard, there's been an infinite amount of hype around blockchain this year. Blockchain will cure the Zika virus. The blockchain will stop wars. Blockchain will improve your sex life. You name it, and all sorts of crazy things. And big four firms wanted to go in and utterly restructure Citigroup or every equity market in the world on a blockchain, and all this kind of foaming at the mouth, kind of rabies-like madness, which is actually one reason that I haven't touched on it on the show so far, and that the show is much more focused on businesses rather than technology and ideas. I mean, there's lots of exciting ideas and technology. We did Bitcoin a couple of years ago. But actually, the interesting thing for me about Coin Salim is actually it is a business. It's a listed business on a stock exchange. So actually, that starts to become something that's a real business rather than a bunch of technologists with ideas or people sort of hyping up the latest idea to try and do the Indian rope trick and get from the sort of floor to the ceiling without any ladders in between. And that's been a fascinating deep dive into ETFs, Laura, and ETNs. I've certainly learned more than I ever knew about ETFs, and going home afterwards, I'm going to feel even more guilty. I haven't been buying them, and I've been wasting my money on far too high management fees. And hopefully, not just the audience have been educated, but some of them who have been lazy like me will actually start scratching their heads as well and join in this sort of $4 trillion market that's increasing rapidly and get better value themselves from investments. So thank you very much, Laura, and most appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.